views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and this is Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Today, I have an exciting array of people coming to join us. I have the CEO of Being a Global Energy, Jack Kelly, and he has a mobile refinery that is 1/30th the size of a traditional refinery, and it has the ability to not only refine natural gas into a usable gas, but it also has the ability to eliminate flaring, which is 5% of the world's atmospheric pollution problem. So they have a really good solution that is a win-win-win for everyone involved, and he's going to explain how that whole thing works. It's really quite amazing. And then I have Reverend Alan Pritz that will be coming to join us, and he's going to be talking about how executives all over the world are turning to meditation to deal with the stress they have in their lives and to bring balance into their life and their family life and everything they have going on. You know, business is very stressful, and meditation is proving to be a good place for these executives, and he'll explain how that all works. And then lastly, I have a person running for president of the United States. His name is Scott Shields, and he calls himself a libertarian Democrat. He's coined the term Demtarian, and he wants to run in the Democratic Party as a libertarian, and he thinks he can win. And he's going to share his issue or his opinions on the issues and everything that he thinks or everything he believes in. So we will get to that after we are done with our first two guests. So let's now introduce Jack Kelly from BNA Global. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Your company has a working oil refinery that is 1/30th the size of a typical refinery, and it's mobile. Is this true, and how the heck did you do that?
Well, I didn't do it personally. The inventor is Michael Wu, a citizen of Taiwan and also a resident of Las Vegas. He's the inventor, the genius behind the technology, and he put it all together and got it built and sold it, and it's being operated currently over the last 3 years overseas.
Well, that's amazing. So it's 1/30th the size. I know I just toured a refinery up here by my house, and it's a big, expensive deal. And, you know, it was one of the larger ones in the country. But the fact that you can do all of that in a mobile unit is amazing. So how much can you, first of all, how large is it?
Well, it actually, the footprint of our one unit, which composes the seven of the components, each of the components are inside a container, built inside a container, standard overseas shipping container that can be put on a flatbed truck or be shipped overseas by container ships. And seven of those containers, they're about 40 foot long and 8 foot wide. That's the footprint of our equipment.
So you just pull up with a semi-truck, and now you have a facility.
Yeah, offload it. You just the semi truck can let it, drop it off on the ground, and it can be slid around by winch trucks to position it in the order that we want it, and then each end is connected.
So you can move it like you would you can move it like you would any kind of container.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So how much production does one of your units give you?
Our units are capable of processing 1.2 million cubic feet of gas per day.
What does that translate into compared to a large or a typical oil refinery?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that question. They are currently building in the process of building three stationary large plants along the coast of Texas. And according to the article, their total investment is about $4 billion per plant.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot. We can build it cheaper. And of course, they announced the production, and I'm not going to tell you what that production at 4 million is. It takes about 1/30th, if you do the math. But if we were to put $4 billion worth of equipment on the ground, it would have a whole lot of units scattered around where they're needed without any pipeline hooked up to it, just sitting around the wells. That $4 billion investment, we will produce more MCF per day, million cubic feet a day than they can.
How much more? 30%, 40%, 300%?
We're about 115 to 20% more efficient than they are.
Wow. Okay. Per it's size. 15, so you're.
Yeah. It's about 15 to 20% more efficient. I don't have that document in front of me, but I've done the math on it.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay. So you're going to get, even though you're 1/30th the size, you're going to just quickly, maybe you're getting 1/27th of the, or 1/25th of the production. But they produce a lot of oil from many different wells, right?
You're talking about they, you mean the
a
large
big refinery.
Plant?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so,
actually, they are collecting gas through pipeline. And we're not replacing that. We are capturing gas that is being wasted because there are no pipelines.
So you're pretty much just going right to the well or to the facility. What do you call it? It's not called, is it called the well?
Oh, the drill sites.
The drill sites.
Oil well.
Yeah, so you're going right to the oil well, but it's to the ones that don't have the pipeline where things are being wasted.
Correct.
And so what problems are you specifically solving?
The problem we're solving is that gas is no longer being wasted and going into the atmosphere, polluting the atmosphere.
Because there's a flaring issue, right?
Because they can't process it. They can't do anything with it.
They simply can't process it because their equipment. What do they do now? When the oil comes out of the well, they put it into a tanker or something and then drive it to a refinery?
Well, with the oil, as it comes flowing out of the wells or being pumped out, that oil has got gas, natural gas, impregnated inside that oil. And it is pumped or flows over into a series of tank batteries. These tanks are 200, 300, 400, 500 barrels each. And in these shale gas places, there's like about a dozen of these large tanks at each well. And so that oil and gas is going into those tanks. Before it goes to the tank, it goes through what they call an oil gas water separator. And that oil gas water separator sends the salt water that comes with it over into salt water tanks. It sends the oil over into the oil tanks. And it sends the gas, what would normally go down a gas pipeline, up into the air.
Okay, so the stuff that's going into the air is called flaring, and it's polluting our atmosphere, right?
Yeah, but because you can't, the government won't let raw gas just let it flow out into the air. You must put a match to it and light it and flare it.
Oh, that's why it's called flaring, because you must light it. Okay, but
yes.
Doesn't that create a lot of pollution?
It creates an awful lot of attention and grief and anger.
Well, but pollution, how much of our pollution that we have right now is coming, if you have those numbers, is coming from lighting gas and creating these flares?
I don't have that number in front of me, but my memory, which sometimes fades me, says it's about 5% of the world's pollution.
The 5% of the world's pollution?
Yes.
And not all countries... And not all countries are even producing gas or oil. So
all wrong.
They all are. Am I wrong?
Well, the overseas countries are flaring more gas than we are.
Oh, well, they don't light it either, do they?
Well, I have to. Yes, of course they do. If you don't flare the natural gas, if you don't light it, it starts killing people.
Oh, okay. It's even a bigger deal.
Oh, yeah.
So they're forced to, otherwise they wouldn't.
That's right.
So now my understanding is your product, your mobile facility, solves that flaring problem.
Absolutely, on the spot.
Because you're separating out that gas and then you're allowing that gas to now be a, not only are you solving the flaring problem, but you're also producing a product.
Absolutely, which we can truck away by truck without the need of a pipeline.
And so this solves two different problems, right? It solves the flaring issue plus the problem of getting to hard-to-reach places.
Yes. It solves the problem of having to build very expensive pipeline infrastructure to a well that may be depleted by the time they get the line to it for a product that is so very cheap. It's viewed as not being economically viable to lay a pipeline to.
It's kind of like it's kind of like telecommunications, where you're running a wire all the way out to somebody in the remote, you know, place.
Yeah, and then by the time you get the wire to that person, they're gone.
Or it's just they're the only ones in a 100-mile radius, and it's too expensive.
Oh, yes, exactly.
But in your case, it's very, very expensive. And if you're going through hard terrain and things, then it's even more expensive.
Right. The Canadians got that problem because they got large flaring gas fields in Alberta, in British Columbia, and gas in Western Canada they're looking at laying pipelines through the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, geez.
Very, very expensive way.
And this could solve that issue.
Well, yes, it'll solve the issue for Canada as well as America.
Well, does it also give us more capacity then, or more, you know, more capacity, but also we can then tap into more oil and gas that we can't get now?
Well, we can always tap into oil and gas if there's oil men that have the funds to spend $1 million to drill the well, and they do have, and they're willing to do that. Price of oil, of course, is now kind of low, so drilling has slowed down. It's not stopped, and it will pick back up again as the oil prices go back.
But basically, it allows the supply to be higher, if you will, because it's less expensive to actually pump it out of the ground. It could allow our supply in the United States to be higher because we can get it for less investment than having to go and bring it in from the Middle East or somewhere else?
Always, it's always cheaper to produce here in America than it is to import it from overseas.
Well, is this a safe process? Because, I mean, everybody's worried about things being safe.
Of course. And, yes, for example, the liquid natural gas, which one of the byproducts from our capturing unit is very safe to transport. What happens with a liquid natural gas truck if it was to drive off the road and bust? Well, all this liquid natural gas would, you can't light something that is minus 261 degrees Fahrenheit. it's a liquid that you cannot put up. You can put a match to it, it'll just go out. It will not burn it. You can't burn it. So what happens is that that liquid natural gas goes back to a vapor, and it rises up into the atmosphere.
And that's the problem.
Slowly.
Is it?
Yeah. So that gas, which you captured, now you've lost. It goes back up in the atmosphere. But it does not explode.
Well, is this, do you think, could you foresee this creating more entrepreneurs that could go in and produce gas? Because let's say I'm a farmer or I'm somebody that has some, have we found oil on my land? Could an entrepreneur with your, you know, this mobile refinery, for how much money could you go in and get a little oil business going?
Well, drop the word oil business. This is the gas business.
Gas business, then.
Okay. And if someone drills the well, the byproduct of that oil well is gas, and oftentimes. Sometimes it's a little bit of gas, and sometimes it's a whole lot of gas. And right now, in these Bakken shales and in Eagle Ford shale fields, these gas fields, these shale fields, there's a lot of natural gas. And it's very profitable for both the drillers who drilled the wells to reap some benefit from the sale of their natural gas, which they cannot right now. And it's profitable to the landowners or the mineral owners who have a piece of that raw product in the ground and now coming out of the ground that they can realize some revenue from.
Well, this is low-hanging fruit to add additional cash flow to their business.
Oh, absolutely. It's really what you would think was a no-brainer.
Well, do you foresee you being able to also refine oil?
No, we will never be in the oil refinery business.
You're just going to stick with the gas. Is it possible to do an oil refinery that's 1/30 the size as well, or haven't even looked at it?
No, it's not possible to do that. Oil is a totally different subject.
Okay.
It's like the oranges in the barrel. We're dealing with the apples.
Okay. And the apples taste better.
Yeah.
At least to a income statement as far as what you guys are trying to do.
Yeah. They're very crispy and they're very sweet.
So how do you foresee this changing the marketplace?
Well, the biggest change is that we bring to the table, to the market, a valuable energy resource that is safe and clean. It's the same thing that you are currently burning in your stoves and your furnaces at home. Clean, safe energy.
Well, I could see entrepreneurs going around and providing this service to oil producers that say, okay, we'll come in, we'll pay you, we'll clean up the gas, and then we'll go and we'll sell it or whatever. Is that a foreseeable thing?
Absolutely.
And so you could.
We're counting on.
Okay. And so you could foresee this. And as a byproduct of all these people having another income source, is we're cleaning up pollution. I could almost see this being a requirement.
I would like for it to be. And, you know, not only is it more income to those folks, it's also millions of jobs, thousands of jobs to states in America.
Well, have you been talking to different government? I would think people would be eating this up. I mean, knowing there's so many environmental factors and people that, you know, there's a big lobby, trying to clean up our atmosphere and things. And I would just think that people would, plus there's just a benefit after benefit. I don't see any negatives here. Are you getting good reception from the government?
Well, we're just now starting to try to make inroads into the government. And one U.S. congressman, I will not mention his name at this point, has offered, has called us and asked us to come to his office in the very near future, actually in November, to meet with him to discuss how it's going to be beneficial and how he can help us.
Well, I think that's great. I just see it as if if you can solve the flaring problem and you can provide additional income, or, you know, on profit margins to people, entrepreneurs need that, right?
Absolutely.
And solve the pollution problem. I can't see it not being the, just the pollution problem by itself being a requirement. I can't see that, you know, if you have a viable solution that's worthwhile.
This should be exciting to everyone, including, you know, the oil and gas operators, to the environmentalists, to the marketplace. It should be very, very exciting.
Well,
to everyone.
And the government could
no-brainer win for everybody.
The government would be requiring something that isn't harmful to these entrepreneurs. It would be they'd be requiring something that makes them more money. So it's a positive deal as long as there's enough suppliers out there that can help them through this. You know, I mean, there's enough people out there that could provide that service. Now, if you have to go and take it on yourself and build that, you know, let's say an entrepreneur is, or a business owner is, has these wells and they just can't right now take on that additional expense or time or whatever. But if there's services out there that provide it to them and all they do is say, okay, come here, do this for us and then we'll get more money for it. We'll get paid. I just can't see it as anything but a no-brainer once
That's
those
exactly
things
our
are
approach.
In place.
You just described our approach. We're going to go to them. We're not asking them for any money. We're asking them just for the right to come on the property and
pay you.
And pay you and capture your gas.
Yeah, give us the right and you'll get more money instead of polluting
exactly.
The atmosphere by 5%.
Absolutely.
Well, this is fantastic. How can people learn more about this?
Well, this radio, hopefully more people will learn more about it. You can go to our website, www.bandaglobalenergy.com and
B-N-A.
Learn more about it.
Okay, well, I will definitely have that up on my radio page. What else?
Call us. Call our office. Talk to us. Tell us how you can help us. We need capital to make the initial investments of the equipment. We need lines of credit to begin exporting our products overseas. There's a lot of money to be made on all
so
these
where,
aspects.
Where are
all
they? Where is it being manufactured?
The products, the equipment currently is being manufactured overseas.
Okay, and could we bring it here?
We can bring it here. In fact, we can bring it to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And all parts and pieces that make up components of our equipment are already here in the United States, and most of them are here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because Tulsa is the original oil capital of the world, and all these little companies that come in and started manufacturing parts for the oil and gas.
So basically, to create it overseas, they're shipping parts from the U.S.
Yes.
So it's a no-brainer that way, too. We can create a whole new
right.
manufacturing environment.
Absolutely.
And we
can
do that quickly.
We manufacture that equipment for ourselves and put them on our wells here in the United States, we can manufacture this equipment and send it to these overseas countries who desperately need this solution to their flaring gas problem. And by exporting our equipment, that's more export capital.
Yeah, we have another export. Instead of always importing everything, now we're building up our manufacturing base. We're helping the pollution problem. We're creating more revenue. We're creating jobs. I don't see this being a negative in any way. Is there a negative?
There is no negative. Everyone should be flabbergasted and excited about what we can do.
You can't see any negative.
None. And I've been looking at this now for quite a while.
It doesn't put anybody out of business. You're not even competing because nobody's serving this purpose anyways. So there should be no friction. Yeah.
There's no one has stepped forward with the capital to get us up and running, start ordering equipment and getting it manufactured.
Well, that should be changed. Well, great. Well,
I agree.
Well, they can get your information up on my radio page and call him if you are interested in this product and talk to your government officials. I think this is wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Absolutely.
If you want any more information on BNA Global and their nifty mobile Refinery, go to my website at sarahwestall.com and I'll have all the information for you there. Now we are going to welcome Reverend Alan Pritz to the program and see how CEOs are utilizing meditation to deal with all the stressors in their life.
Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Sarah. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, you work with a lot of people and teach them how to do meditation. Are you seeing more professionals turning to meditation to deal with the stressors of their job and with life?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question you ask because there is an ever-increasing recognition of the value of meditation, particularly for CEOs because of the high level of performance expectation and stress that these folks encounter. And in fact, Bill George, as you may know, who is formerly the head of Medtronic, has been very active at Harvard, teaching and writing for the Harvard Business Review, and is a real champion of meditation, and has, you know, fairly recently written and chronicled the various different kinds of corporate venues where meditation is very much a fact of life. You know, anything from General Mills, Goldman Sachs, Google, Apple, Medtronic, Aetna. These are just to name a few. And in fact, Harvard Business School has indicated a feeling that both meditation training and intuition development are skill sets that are necessary for the cutting edge of, basically business and leaders right now and going forward.
Well, pretty much you have to have a way to deal with that stress. Otherwise, it comes out in other ways, right? I mean, you end up doing things that you don't want to do if you don't have a way of dealing with stress, or you internalize it and it becomes a health problem.
Yeah, you know, stress is one of those kinds of things that has a vestigial kind of macho quality associated with it.
People, I don't think it has macho. I think it's evil.
when I mean macho, there's the sense of I have encountered so many people that are experiencing really debilitating circumstances in their life. And when a person such as myself indicates that it may be stress related, you know, because it seems cloud-like, vaporous, insubstantial, and it has a what I call kind of a quality of unsubstantiability to it that makes people feel a little nervous with accepting that kind of thing has such a impact on their life. But in fact, it very much does, and some of the kinds of disorders that are associated with it, you know, are anxiety, depression, heart disease, high blood pressure, sleep problems. And in the workplace, this can translate into a number of things with a compromised clarity, focus, employee relationships, teamwork, communication, absenteeism.
Explosive behavior?
Well, yeah, definitely, because that is simply a result of frustration, anger, and things which are contained that people do not have appropriate skill sets and channels to exercise and know how to manage. So all of this stuff forms a very toxic cocktail.
And that's very common in today's work, especially with the demands that you have, to the performance demands, a salesperson or somebody who has a direct contact with the high demands can be a coach, you know, like a coach of a very public team, or, you know, things where you're just really out there and exposed. It can be pretty stressful.
Well, you know, what I find these days is that many people are working either longer hours with their job or multiple jobs. And the cumulative toll with that kind of taxing of one's physical and psychic system, as well as the domestic scene when people are done, you know, this is just too much. There is really not good mechanisms in place for people to know how to manage the intensity that is before them, whether they're at a high-level professional game or just called to perform longer hours. And these kinds of things are cumulative. There's no way that a person is going to shed them without having some kind of skill set to do so. So, you know, it's very much an epidemic kind of scenario.
Well, how does it help you deal with it? Does it just calm, give you a peaceful place? I mean, how does it help you?
Well, it's an interesting thing. First of all, much verbiage is given to meditation these days and very little in terms of definitions. So there are a range of different kinds of meditation styles, programs, and practices. One has to understand that meditation really did arise and has its foundational roots in spiritual practice, the realization of oneself in relationship with spirit, the divine, however they relate to it. In a workaday world, however, there are more extracted elements from these practices which are put into place so that people are able to use some of the skill sets or the techniques associated with these practices, but somewhat winnow away the spiritual elements and focus on the mental, physical byproducts that arise from particular skills with breathing, mental focus, stillness, concentration, and focus. All of these things tend to have a spit shine for the physical system as well as for the mind.
Now, does it help you become a higher performer as well? So if you, well, I suppose if it helps you concentrate, it helps you deal with situations better, it helps you, I mean, there's, you could maybe close more deals if you could just keep your emotions in check, right? And meditation, I would think, would really help you keep your emotions in check. It would help you deal with all the different anxiety issues that you may get, which impedes you, your performance.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that there is a kind of mystique associated with meditation, and I understand that. The simplest way that I can say is that, you know, if a person is a butcher, they need to have sharp knives. Okay. If a person is an athlete, they need to have top skills in the area that they're involved with. And whenever a person can improve their capacity for perception, for clarity, for calmness, for efficiency, all of these things go into enhancing a person's overall performance. And so when you ask about, you know, does this affect a person's efficiency? Does this affect a person's ability to broker deals or discuss presentations? Certainly it will, because the fact of the matter is that a person has all their eggs lined up in a basket and they wind up being able, well, they show up with more of themselves there. Their pencil is sharpened, if you will, ready to perform because the innate qualities of themselves are less submerged beneath stress and the various different fragmenting factors that go on in the day. They wind up being able to deliver.
Well, with time being such a precious commodity, how are professionals able to fit it in their schedules? And I know, you know, you need to stop to sharpen the knife to be able to get things done quicker. But, you know, with the demands that everyone has, how are they able to fit this into their schedule?
This is not an uncommon issue, and typically when I'm working with people, we wind up having opportunities to just kind of explore what are the, I will say, the optional areas in their life, and it winds up being a matter of dedicating time and priorities. You know, oftentimes people have more time, believe it or not, than they might be aware of, and it's a function of choosing what they want to allocate their time for. Now, bear in mind, a person doesn't need to spend hours a day to get benefit from doing this kind of practice. Sometimes just 15 minutes once or twice a day is all that's required to really get a person started. And, you know, whether it's getting up early or staying at work or finding ways that they, it's a matter of scheduling. And really, this is oftentimes just a function of taking a look and becoming clear of what the options are and making choices that align with what your needs are.
And you can be creative, right? You could do this maybe in your office as part of lunch break, or you could just, if you're starting to feel stressed and you don't have a meeting for another half an hour, you could do it just right then, right?
Yeah, certainly so. And in fact, I encourage people to be flexible with their, it's a mixture of being dedicated to a practice and flexible with when they can get to it. Oftentimes I find that because we're habited beings, it's helpful for people to set certain times and stick with them. But, you know, when people can't do that, what you said is spot on. There are various different opportunities and occasions that arise. A lot of businesses right now are allowing employees to use certain spaces for meditation. An office, if you have one, is a great luxury. And if you don't, a cubicle, if you close your eyes. And, you know, there are things I've told people, if you need to, just get outside at lunch, go to the restroom if needful for just a minute. Little things that a person can do, they're like pearls on the necklace, that when you string them together, they become very much of a helpful array.
Well, where can people go to see more of your work? I know you've done a national best-selling book, and you have a lot of other information. You have a blog. Where can people go to see more of your work?
You know, really the simplest thing for folks is just to go to my website, and that is www.awakeinlife.com. So it is awake-in-life.com. And there's a variety of information there about the services I provide as well as how to contact me. And typically I make myself available to meet with people, usually for free, for a half hour consultation to find out what their needs are and if I am the best fit for them. So it's, you know, I'm a very user-friendly kind of professional here because my intention is really to help folks, and I know how valuable these practices and procedures can be.
Well, I will have your information all up on my radio page and my website so people can get to that if they want. And I know if anybody's like me, you need to figure out ways to deal with stress in your life. So I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this.
Well, you're most welcome. And as I say, this is my area, and I've been doing this for many, many years. So I'm very comfortable with working with a range of folks and whatever their particulars might be, no matter how silly it might seem or complicated, there's always a way that we can work on something. So again, thank you very much, Sarah, for having me on.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too.
Again, if you want to get any information on my guests, go to my website, sarahwestall.com. Now I am bringing you Scott Shields, the Demtarian presidential candidate.
Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us today.
I look forward to it.
Well, you have a lot of different experience in business and have been involved in different ventures. Where do you see the biggest opportunities right now?
Well, back in 2012, I jumped into the electric vehicle sector to do some assessment on the viability on scale of the electric vehicle sector. And I actually came out of it believing that there's extreme viability for scale if things are applied correctly during the stages of manufacturing, distribution, sales, and consumer awareness. So I think the electric vehicle sector is still in stage one of what the possibilities are. And I think that is a pretty exciting area. I think some people, because oil prices have gone down, they've always created the philosophy that the electric vehicles, you know, the gas prices will dictate consumer acceptance.
Sure.
And marketing and investment. And I think we're beyond that now.
Well, why is it taking so long to get the electric vehicle going? Is it really the panacea that people say it could be?
Well, I don't know if it's a panacea, but it definitely, you know, has enormous market share opportunity. The larger traditional companies obviously have vested interest in their traditional manufacturing, the labor unions that create those, the supply chain and parts and service that goes along with that. So the transition actually is a disruptor, and it's not just in the oil sector. It's a disruptor in areas of the auto manufacturing, which has always been a large percentage of our economy.
Well, the whole chain, right? Because you're talking gas stations, you're talking the distribution of everything, you know, how the cars are made. And plus you need to, you know, when you're talking about green energy and things, people talk that the batteries in cars are worse than the fossil fuels that are used to fuel a car. Now, is that inaccurate for the new products that are coming out?
Well, I don't think it's not accurate when you're on smaller and mid-sized scale. If you were to scale electric vehicles, obviously you have to create electricity, which one of the biggest drivers is coal. So you'd have to create, you know, more electricity through coal manufacturing, which is not good for the environment. So until you get the scale, in theory, it could be worse. But the concept would be by that time, advancements would be, you can't really get the scale. Let me go back. The electric vehicles can't get to that type of scale to hurt the economy or hurt the environment.
And we're hoping that the electric producing plants will evolve to the point where they're using solar and other means so that
Correct.
It actually is better
Correct.
For them. Okay, that makes sense.
That's the logical path, whether that can be implemented or not. You know, it takes a lot of cooperation.
Well, do you think they can eliminate the need for fossil fuels in vehicles?
I do in vehicles. I think the electric vehicle, the range is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years. I think there's going to be some extraordinary advances in the range application, which will be a game changer.
And are all the car companies invested in this, or is it just Tesla, for
no,
example?
No, you have everybody's vested in it. The question is this, you know, I wrote a long time ago, the intersection of progress and tradition is fraught with alienation until success.
Yeah,
when you're trying to push progress, you know, there is traditional factors that are in play. And they typically now are so large, traditional auto manufacturers and everybody involved in it, that they don't want to be the leader in it. They would, you know, prefer to somebody else be the leader. And then they have to, you know, the market forces will force them to say, okay, we're losing enough market share. We either have to acquire Tesla or other ones, or we have to compete at a high level. So,
well, isn't there go ahead.
You just elaborate on that. My personal opinion is I hope Tesla is never acquired, because I think once that happens, it gets
shut
down
a
lot. Well, I wouldn't say shut down, but it gets slowed down.
Because they're more innovative in their smaller company versus being eaten up by GM or something?
Well, I think they have a whole new approach to not just manufacturing the vehicle, but the distribution channel.
Sure.
So there's a lot of people that I'm sure are not in favor of that. In fact, you see some states and the lobbyist groups of the car manufacturers putting pressure on state legislators for Tesla not to be able to sell.
That's great. I suppose that's not free market.
No, it's basically protectionism and isolation. You know,
it goes against the grain of our country, I guess, you know, to say you can't sell this product here. Well, do you think there's a lot of geopolitical issues when it comes to not utilizing the fossil fuels?
No, I think obviously the largest user of fossil fuels is, you know, the military complex. So,
well, wouldn't this affect them and their vehicles?
Obviously, there's a need there currently. So,
well, with airplanes and jets and those things.
Everything.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, ships, you know, that you can't. There's still some time to break through some new technology that might possibly come out and quicker than most people think. But we'll see what happens.
Well, I understand, and I've been made aware that you've been positioning yourself for entering the presidential race as a Democrat. Is that true?
I have indeed. And it's actually, I specialize in brand development, marketing, distribution, and strategic planning for scale. And I have been involved in the economic sector and the political sector to some degree with people. So I'm pretty astute to what's going on. I do get calls from people for me to, as a strategic planner, how do I see what is going to occur next?
Well, when are you going to officially go forward? Are you planning on joining the next debate?
Well, we were waiting to see how last night's debate went. And
well, how do you think it went?
I think they all represented themselves well, but I think if you know, very similar to the other parties' question and answers, they seem to be not solution oriented. It's still anti somebody else or going back to a traditional mindset of what they believe the solutions are. The seven categories or seven areas that I believe are very critical. One of them being prioritizing our national security decisions. I don't think I heard any answers there that come up with any solutions there.
No, I think they touched on some hot button issues, but nobody really talked about how to create a solution around that.
Right. And obviously it's a high priority. And then the other one would be economic stability and advancement. It's the same talking points. So I don't see any innovative economic solutions, coming out of there. More Republicans do want this, and we want more Keynesian economics.
Do they understand it?
I think what's happened, it's very similar. I think the electric vehicle sector can kind of give you a little idea on how new visions are applied. They're not new economic theory is a disruptor. So you have the traditional thought process of the Republican Party. You have the traditional thought process of the Democratic Party. So both of them have a traditional economic answer. And
that's what got us into our mess.
Well, the times, I wrote on this a long time ago, the times move on. Globalization, worldwide economic globalization is moving very quickly. 300 years ago, you had a boat with a message on it. And if you were doing a trade deal.
Things are different.
Things move quicker. So, I always preface that societies are extremely difficult to manage and operate. So I don't look at any of the candidates as candidates not capable of doing it. I look at the people they surround themselves with more like, coattails of the past, and they're more interested in not bringing in new solutions that could be like a Tesla, where you're going to be alienated even by some in your peer group, besides the peer group that you're opposing. So I don't see anybody there that in the Democratic Party, which is traditionally where a progressive thought, progressive ideas are going to come out of and create success.
What do you think differentiates you from Hillary and Bernie? Bernie's really, he really has a fire in his belly, very anti Wall Street and bankers. And that really has a, bipartisan. There's a lot of frustration with Wall Street and bankers in the world today.
Well, there's no doubt. And I think that the answer there is, his approach, his knowledge may be correct, but I believe his approach is wrong. He is still, you hear the very, I'm going to go back to this analogy in the electric vehicles. A lot of people got in and invested in the electric vehicle sector because they're anti-oil. Okay, the people that help promote electric vehicle. I've always been a believer that's not a good motivation. It may be a good motivation in the beginning to identify why you don't like oil and how it disrupts the environment and, the possibilities and things like that. But I think that the inner emotion of anti somebody because is not a good thing.
It's not actually good to build on negative. It's good to build on opportunity and
well, because you're going to be the next tradition. If we're the electric vehicle company, okay, we're the next tradition. If we gain market share and I'm sure we won't be perfect, as we mentioned earlier, you got to produce electricity, right? So there'll be something else, and we'll be looked at as a traditional company, and there'll be new technologies that we are working on as well. That might surpass the electric vehicle or may be right behind it. So, we're not anti-electric vehicles with that technology. We're just in the market. I'm a capitalist. I'm a green capitalist.
So you're a capitalist. You're not like you're not a social. He's a, what a capital a democratic socialist. Is that what he calls?
Well, yeah, he's a democratic socialist. He states that. Now, how he, I think he actually is a capitalist. He just doesn't. It's just a word track. I think Bernie would align with me very closely in my solutions. I think that he's the anti-Wall Street is because the Democrats are not putting forward correct solutions for the economy and the tax code. So they're more anti something, so they create their policies on an anti.
Well, socialism is bigger. I mean, you want government to solve problems for you versus letting the people solve their own problems, giving the means to let them solve the problems, get government out of the way so they can accomplish things. And entrepreneurialism is giving them tools and letting the genius come from the people.
Correct. And even Putin understands that. And he even in interviews has said that's what he respects about America more than anything. And being an ex-KGB agent, he probably understands our society better than most in Washington do.
So, yeah, that's probably right.
I'm quite sure of it, actually.
Sure. Unfortunately.
But that's off topic there. But the antitrust teachings are very important. Okay, what Bernie and Hillary and the Democratic Party and Elizabeth Warren, the inability of the antitrust department to actually do their job or actually write new laws of what should be what I believe antitrust laws are not being implemented. So you can't rely on. You know, they use the word crony capitalism.
Well, yeah, because the government is so tied into Wall Street and paid off and everything else.
And so if the government and the economic sector are colluding, which I call a collusionary democracy and collusionary capitalism, that's actually the start of socialism. That's actually where socialism becomes socialism. So it's already been in place. So Bernie, I think, is kind of off track here because communism, religious theocracies, dictatorships, and socialism are they are the ultimate crony capitalism.
Yeah, they take the freedoms away from the people instead of
absolutely.
And that's why we are in the problem we're in is because people are unable to solve a lot of their own problems because they don't have the tools and the corporations and government are getting in their way.
I think it's a truthfully, being in the game a little bit, both parties, you always have to look at what someone's primary objective is and what their motivation is. And I had this discussion the other day with some prominent people, and they agreed. It's all about power. And then you have to divine, why do they want the power so much? And both parties want the power so much because they want to have the next person on the Supreme Court. That's where all the money is coming in to support these candidates. The ultimate power position is being able to place someone on the Supreme Court. So they are more vested in that than the priorities of what we just talked about. I mean, you and I didn't just talk about the biggest priority of America is to make sure we get our person we support on the Supreme Court, correct?
Well, that's
not what we're doing, but that's what they're doing.
Well, and I don't think I can see that. That's great that you pointed that out because the American people don't understand that. Well, okay, Bernie's is a self-proclaimed socialist, and people believe that he's going to have a really hard time winning with that type of platform. But Hillary's not. She's straight up the middle. She's a female, which people feel is we're ready for that. And she's a leading candidate. What differentiates you from her other than being a guy? Because that's not fair.
Well, I think what differentiates me from Hillary is – no, I think what differentiates me more than some may believe – is the fact that she said she's a progressive last night. I heard her say that. I think there was a question, am I a progressive or a moderate? And I don't know what that means, but she was really adamant to say she's a progressive. So I think we have a different definition of what progressiveness is. I think progressive thoughts are not designed to crush tradition. They should be aligned to work with tradition. And I think she's become a traditionalist. I mean, the dollars that she's worth through government and the way she's, how much money she's made, I guess my question would be, how many people have you hired? How many people have you, you know, the greatest charity there is to hire somebody. Ask Bill Gates. Ask the, you know, Google and Apple and General Motors.
And all small business people across the country busting their butt just to make payroll
Absolutely. And that's the best charity there is. And we I've written on this before that, and I wrote that I worked with England quite a bit on this. You know, the evolution of Europe is obviously socialist. And one of the things that we don't want to duplicate, and China's studied to try to not duplicate, is you don't want the dollars to go, if you have unions, and China will have unions one day too. If you have unions, you want unions in the private sector, not the public sector. Because you need wages in the private sector so taxes can come in to pay for what the services are required that people want, and the public sector can administer them and implement them. We started to do it backwards a while ago. We went to the cheapest labor formula that we could, China, India.
That's why we're having so many issues, but we still need to compete on a world stage, right?
Well, here's where that evolves. Okay, I was a firm believer. I'm an Adam Smith believer as a Democrat. I'm an Adam Smith believer that globalization and trade helps create peace and prosperity. You have interaction of different races, religions. People have never spoke together, got to know each other, have only been propagandized by the hate groups and the anti-these.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, but that's human.
Need to evolve as people. That's why
we need leadership. Leadership that sells that.
But that's why I love the idea that we're starting to see a lot of diversity running for office, you know, for this presidential debate on the Republican side, especially, but just so people see it.
Absolutely.
We need to evolve as a society and elect people that represent the people, you know, all different sectors, but keep going.
Well, it sounds like you understand what I believe, which is competition creates a better path of progress. So that, I guess, again, that's where the difference between me and Hillary may be. She's become a traditionalist, believing that her philosophies of the past, where she probably was a progressive in many areas and helped start a lot of things that are very good for our society. But now many of those things, for instance, school vouchers. I would doubt that she's for school vouchers. School vouchers are a progressive idea. Okay? That's a progressive idea for things to get better.
Yeah.
Yet she will say that she's with the traditional way of the past. So you have to identify, when people say they're progressive, you really have to micro it down to where the priorities are in that progressive thought or that traditional thought.
Well, people get confused over the words, too. And then you're not really saying anything because everybody has a different idea of what it means.
They group it as an anti those people.
Yeah. Whatever that means, right?
Well, no, because I'm a liberal. And I'm a liberal thinker. I mean, I am, without a doubt. But I respect a lot of traditional values that the Republicans and people believe in, the religious aspect and how they believe society should be run. Okay, so there is a way to mutually merge that. But, and this is where Bernie's right, and this is why I like Bernie and I like Carson, I like Trump, and I like anybody, like you said, that's been Fiorina. And anybody that's coming in that's going to disrupt the power that's there to put people at the Supreme Court. And you may think that's not accurate, but believe me, that's everything. I've sat on both sides of this aisle as advisors and assessment people, and it's all about placing someone on the Supreme Court. That's where the pressure points come in. So that has to change. So we do need somebody, and
change, because otherwise our focus is out of whack.
Oh, it gets very much out of whack. There's no doubt that is why you have more of the anti. I don't think anybody can be anti-Republican or anti-Democrat because there may be tax code change, you know, or someone comes up with an economic stability plan for advancement of everybody in America. I don't think they can if someone prioritizes our national security decisions. Now, once they hear the solutions, there's going to be people that dissect them. But I can tell you, most of the dissecting away from correct solutions is because someone's losing power.
Well, yeah, because they don't want you to mess around with what they have going on. Well, so do you believe in more regulations for the banking sector and Wall Street, or just enforcement?
Oh, I definitely, as an antitrust person, again, we have a problem with the bankers being, and I wrote on, I agree completely, they should not be in the insurance and the investment area, in the, you know, the PE area.
Well, there was a lot of criminal activity, and we didn't prosecute anyone, and now the statute of limitations are all expiring, so there we have it. We have a bunch of people up there that...
Well, as a libertarian, I believe we have too many laws. Okay, I think if you create the right policies, then people won't break the laws. I mean,
sociopathic people up there. So you'd consider yourself a democratic libertarian?
I consider myself a democratic libertarian, and as a brand manager, brand development person, I've branded myself as the Dimtarian candidate.
Well, that's great. How will you get the word out? How are you going to do that? What's going on? What plan do you have?
And this is where Bernie and I disagree. Okay. I believe that money is very critical to be in the process. I believe that, lobbyists need to be around. Nobody knows everything. I don't know everything. You don't know everything. They don't know everything. You need people to give you information so then you can
make. But should they be called lobbyists, or just you need certain experts around?
Well, no, I think I like to hear from people with emotion that may not be an expert. I mean, the experts are many times don't know what's going on in the human condition in many places. You know, they may read it, but they don't have any of the Scottish education of experience and observation. You know, there's book read learning, and then there's implementation learning. So if you're only book read learning, you need to touch people and find out what's going on. They may know more and have some solutions that people that are book smart don't have.
Well, that's true. But if you have lobbyists that are very well funded and they're all trying to go towards one direction, and we don't, you as a candidate or you as a president don't understand that particular sector, the lobbyists with the most money that are, without you knowing, you know, I mean, it's important to get that balance.
Right. Here's how I answer that. If you don't, you know, there's an old written rule. Know what you know and know what you don't. If a lobbyist is giving you something that you don't know, then you have to do some research to see if what they're saying is viable for the solution that you're trying to implement.
And whether it's one-sided and whether they have a motive there that's not good for society.
If it agrees with what your solutions are, you should be writing your own solutions and not relying on the lobbyist. So, but then you should be explaining to the lobbyists, these are the solutions we want. How can you help us? Okay, I think that's the backwards part right now. We have the lobbyists coming in because we have zero ethics, in my opinion, on the people that are talking to the lobbyists in Washington, D.C. I believe they're not there. That's where the ethics, it's very similar. If you're a buyer for a grocery store, and I do some brands for in the food business. If a buyer is going to take money and be in the payroll, you know, have payola, and you'll see this overseas everywhere, America, no. If they take money and payola, because that's their cultural, that's what they think is fine, which I believe is terrible. Okay, it really crushes competition and business and ethics. But if they take money, then guess what? The next person that calls on them knows that, recognizes that, and guess what they have to do? They have to offer money. So is it the people that are offering the money is the problem, or is it the buyer? The buyer is the problem. So the people that are receiving the money in Washington are the problem.
Well, they're taking bribes.
they're taking bribes. I mean, they actually had to write a law on themselves on insider trading. Hello?
Well, should there be a law?
Hello? I mean, I love the prosecutor. I mean, this is, we call it this. I mean, the people that are in the know, we've identified this through many places. And yeah, our politicians are like the clergy prior to the French Revolution. They're politicians for convenience and lifestyle. And then they get out and bark against the other person to say they're not that way. But they are that way. They're actors.
Well, everybody sees themselves as a certain way.
I don't want to be critical of them because, I preface this, societies are very difficult to manage and operate. Globalization has moved our societies around the world very quickly. And everybody's trying to manage them under the premise of the old traditional ways of how they've thought.
Well, and if you make one mistake in this microscope environment, it's going to be on, on the news, or it's going to be somewhere.
And that shouldn't matter. I mean, to be honest with you.
Because everybody's going to make a mistake. Everybody's going to be tired.
You should go out,
give me a break.
Go out there. If you can't laugh, what's the old rule? I was taught this by great parents. I guess I'm fortunate. If you can't laugh at yourself, you can't laugh with others.
Well, yeah. If you don't make a mistake, you're not human. And you should,
right.
And you should evolve your understanding as you get more information. Cause you're only going to make decisions based on the information that you have.
Absolutely.
And then as you get more information, your decisions better change. We don't want you to be just stuck in your same role because you don't have access to all the information.
Absolutely. And that's where, Hillary is correct. I think she's doing it to say because of politics, but,
she
made that statement,
She's right.
Night.
She's right. That's just a
fact. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a fact.
Absolutely. And it's right on both sides. But
exactly.
the Democrats ripped the Republicans for doing it. So that's what I'm saying.
Well.
And it is the press. The press, I hate to say, you may be in the press, you're interviewing me now, but unfortunately, the leadership and the media corporations, they make a lot of money by pitting Democrats and Republicans against each other, not in an intellectual argument or discussion, if they can fight each other, because then people donate a lot of money to the campaigns, and that money is geared toward advertising in the media. Okay, if you look at the media returns, I do. I know what they make, and it's a lot of money. Okay, and they don't like Donald Trump for that too, because Donald Trump can go get an interview. I can go get an interview once I start. I'll talk on MSNBC. I'll talk on Fox. I'll talk. Why wouldn't you talk to anybody that wants to talk to you?
You would. Yeah, I mean,
it
just doesn't make sense not to. It's free advertisement.
Well, and why wouldn't you want to reach across?
That's what I'm
to
saying.
Everybody, what your opinions are,
exactly,
and what your solutions are. It doesn't make sense at all. And this is where I think the Democrats need a person like me to counter Donald Trump, who everybody's underestimating, because I do know the gentleman, and I do know the forces behind him, and I do know the intellect, and he is someone that, if he stays in it, health-wise and motivation-wise, he's probably going to win it.
Okay, well, I got a question. Is his hair real? Is it a comb over or is it a rug?
Well, last night
they made a little.
Let's say it's a huge comb over. I don't know. I don't know the man personally. I know people that do know him, and because I'm in the golf arena as well, and they speak highly of him, I think you have to look at why you like Donald Trump and why you like Scott Shields as candidates. I've been involved in advising of leverage buyouts, and Donald Trump's a leverage buyout gentleman. And what a leverage buyout person does is they go and they buy a bankrupt company and they rebuild it. Romney did that as well. That is a skill set that we need in America right now.
We need somebody that understands business, who's hard. I mean, they're hard-nosed. They're not afraid to back down. They understand the games that Wall Street plays. They need to be smart enough to understand what's going on. They can't just be into. I'm sorry. I'm telling you what you need. You can't be intellectually.
I hope you think I'm that person for the Democrats.
Well, I hope so.
Here's why I'm saying. Here's why I'm saying that.
I'm afraid people don't even know how to solve the problems because it's just from them. It's all theoretical. It's like you need to have been in there and got
been kicked around a while and understand how dirty it
is.
I disagree with that. What you have to do is know that when you go into companies that are bankrupt, and Donald Trump's right and I'm right on this.
Yeah.
You build a team to dissect the business and why it went bankrupt.
Sure. Yep.
Okay. And why it went bankrupt, and then you reorganize it. So then it grows on scale to profit.
It grows healthy. It's a healthy.
It grows healthy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But what I'm saying is that
in America, that's exactly what we need. America's bankrupt. It's bankrupt financially. It's bankrupt morally.
I don't think there's any problems.
Right. So the other part is I don't see anybody that was one of the sectors that I'm a huge believer in is we need an American spiritual enlightenment.
Well, the other thing is, I think you have to be honest.
And that doesn't mean a Christian one. That just means a spiritual enlightenment of love toward other people.
Be aware of what, but you have to be aware of what's going on too. I mean, you have to be aware of the games that the people play. I mean, if you haven't been in it and seen and heard them talk about it, you might not understand to the level of the games that they play. They're pretty astute. You know, they don't get to where they are. Wall Street doesn't get to where they are without being – and I actually think some of those guys are psychopaths.
What Wall Street wants more than anything else is good governance in the political sector, okay, and an understanding that they're not the enemy, okay? They are not the enemy. We do need capital markets. We do need what they do.
We need the good people there, just not the bad. The bad people need to be taken out of that sector, just like every other sector.
Exactly. But I'm not the FBI, so.
Well, if you were elected, you'd be the community.
And I guess that's where I'm different than Hillary too. I don't think I would be investigated by the FBI. And if I am, there'd be nothing there for them to start an indictment for.
You don't have a bunch of skeletons in your closet.
Right. And I think that's where her, some of us believe this happens with power all across the world. I mean, power does create paranoia. Okay.
I'm sure.
As you get older, I mean, I don't know if she's taken any psych tests. I mean, I don't think, if you're in certain areas of the military or CIA, you have to take psych tests. And, maybe some of these people in Washington need some psych tests because they are human beings and they are people abroad are studied, in leadership, people like Gaddafi and everybody else as they grow, to power.
Sure.
Putin's being studied by everybody in the world. I don't know that some of our people should be immune to that as well. I mean, they are human beings. They do put a lot of pressure on themselves to be successful for the right reasons. But they do grow old and they do, they're in the fray of what I've seen. If I were in that fight for 20 years and actually in it, like Hillary's been in it, you'd have to be a little jaded probably.
That's probably true. Having a family that's been in it for a long time, kind of like the Bushes. Oh. I can't imagine the Bush. How could you be a Bush and not be a little jaded?
Same type of thing. And I think that's where America, I talked to my political advisor who's been in this for quite a while. And I ask questions. I mean, you have to, in an area that you don't, I know a little bit, but I wanted to get the pulse on the population. And and I asked them the questions I needed. And I said, tell me if I'm right, because if I'm wrong, I need to know. I don't want to push this forward with my financial backer and everybody else. Is America going to a populist? Is it a populist nation now? Populist electorate. And this was last year in May. So what year is 2014? And he said, Scott, I completely believe it is. But we'll do some more homework on it. And the Democratic Party is, I was asking him because I'm a registered independent, should I run as a Republican or a Democrat? And after telling him everything about me, he said, the Democratic Party is where you need to be because it needs the reformation. It is a populist country out there, and the Republicans don't have anybody, and they're not going to invite you to the table. the Democratic Party will invite you to the table once you get out there. And there'll be people, obviously, that you're going to be against. But
yeah, not everybody's going to invite you. I don't see Hillary inviting you to the table.
And you, oh, I don't know. She could. I mean, I don't know. I mean, she could be a vice president. I don't know who I have people I would already prefer, but she won't beat me. She won't beat me if I do.
Well,
get
why do you think you'll get the votes you need?
Because I'm the populist candidate and I have the solutions in the areas that we're talking about. I think people are looking for solutions. They didn't hear solutions last night. They heard same traditional arguments that don't qualify as solutions. They do qualify as solutions to the sheep, and we're all sheep to some degree, so I don't want to be critical, to people that have bought into the unidimensional thought process because these people have been in leadership so long.
Sure.
So Republicans have the same thing. We're all subject to that, okay? If you are someone that really follows politics, and as an independent, you follow it, you're in it, you're out of it, you're not obsessed with it. But for people that are in the political area and they're obsessed with it, they become unidimensional in their thought process following the people they want in office.
Well, and that happens in business, too. You become groupthink. And
that's
why you need to hire people outside to get fresh perspectives.
Let me tell you, when I met with the CEO of General Motors, we said, Scott, what are you doing in the electric vehicle business? I said, this. And it wasn't like, oh, come head up General Motors electric vehicle division. You know why? Because they don't want it to be successful.
Well, yeah. That's funny.
Well, no, they don't. I mean, they want to produce enough vehicles to meet CAFE standards. Otherwise, they're going to be fine. And this is where regulation doesn't necessarily help innovation either. I mean, you know, behind the scenes, I don't want to get into conversations with people that I've had, but the realities are, you know, innovation has to come from visionaries who gain capital and are not hindered by the traditional distribution and financial and political arena. I think that alignment with Obama and General Motors, it really hurt the electric vehicle sector.
Sure.
And there are ways to transition the economic sector, you know, that's being lost. Just like I'm from Illinois and I came out to California after college. And I remember everybody saying computers were going to take away so many jobs, right?
Well, they are starting to. I mean, the automation of processes and stuff. But go ahead.
They did, but they created new jobs as well.
Yes.
And now what wasn't done right is what the transition of the people that are losing the jobs. We don't transition them until after years later, and we find out everybody's
absolutely. And that's the problem we're in right now.
Right. You have to transition. You have to educate. I'm a firm believer that our colleges are way late. We wanted to educate everybody in America. Everybody, your kid, my kid, everybody's kid get educated. It's a great thing. But we didn't build more colleges.
Well, we also aren't necessarily educating them in the way that we need them either.
Well, I'm not going to get into that. I believe, you know, there's whatever, but I would say this, it's real.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation. But if you look, I'm talking supply and demand. We wanted to create more supply of people to get educated.
Yeah.
But we didn't meet the demand. So what happened is kids have to declare their major. They have to declare their major before they go to college. I think it's probably a good thing for kids to learn how to adapt for a year or two and take liberal arts and the brightest and the best, if they want to become doctors or architects or lawyers or whatever, they'll find their path. These kids have to declare their major to get into a USC or somewhere.
Yes, you're right.
And I'm an architect, and now I got to be in the architect school for, and I might have been the brain trust that cured cancer.
You're right. I mean, you got to let them explore, and the bright ones need to be able to do where their passion lies. I'm really
What happened is because we didn't have enough college availability, that all these requirements and grade test scores and the drive to get the stores and all these things have, you know, I believe you're in the education area. So, you know, this, in my opinion at the time, was insane. And so my suggestion was for academia to start allowing people to take classes on the internet. This was 15, 20 years ago. If you can get into Stanford or Santa Clara or USC or University of Minnesota or University of Illinois, set up a secondary path, you know, through the internet where people can take classes and not, if they can't afford the tuition or if they didn't meet the standards that you want, you know, because the standards are going high, that there was a second tier that could be a participant.
Yeah, because sometimes the brightest aren't making the standards initially because they were too young to understand how important it was.
You have to expand the ability. If you're going to create demand, you have to expand the supply.
Well, you know, I don't have much time here yet. We're wrapping up, but
yeah.
When are we going to see
will you vote for me, Sarah?
Well, I can, you know. I tend to be down the middle, and I tend to be more of an independent. I like aspects of all parties, but right. You know, I'm a business person. I hope to see you in the next debate.
Let's try to. You can help me out in that regard.
How do I do that?
So, let's make this thing go viral.
That would be nice.
Well, all right, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed the talk, and hopefully I said things that are okay to say
in
this interview. And I enjoyed it, and, I will be out there. It's just a matter of after watching that debate. I was hoping in a way that last night would address – I thought they did – the good thing, they did talk about topics, okay? The questionnaire, Anderson Cooper?
Yeah,
I do believe so much better than the Republican debate where it was personalities and, you know, he did ask questions on topic. And the unfortunate thing is we heard the same traditional solutions that don't work. Let me back up and say this. If you've been in the industry for a while and the results are what they are now, you have to take some blame on that.
you haven't been leading.
And Hillary doesn't do that. Bernie's not doing that. I think the other three candidates are really nice people, but there's no way they can win.
You're going to go in there and shake it up and say, hey, I'm a business person. I get this. I see from a business perspective that we're bankrupt, and I can make this. I can change this.
I can, and I can knock down the deficit better than anybody. I definitely can. I have the relationships overseas, foreign relationships that are vital, and they're behind me. Not for the reasons of. You have to realize that. Emerging nations, even socialist nations, religious theocracies, people that live in dictatorships, communist countries, they actually respect capitalism and want capitalism in their nation.
Well, and we don't really have capitalism.
We have collusionary democracy right now, which is hampering capitalism, which is hampering the expansion of prosperity and peace here in America and around the world.
Our wealth for everybody, and we have all sorts of issues.
Everybody can't be wealthy, but everybody.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean there's a tier, and there's always going to be a tier. The question is how do we take care of those that can't take care of themselves?
But there'd be a bigger middle class. The middle class is eroding, and there'd be a bigger middle class if people that have ideas and solutions aren't hampered by government and big companies squashing them. And I mean, if there was a little more freedom in that realm.
Antitrust, a better antitrust policy, and a change of labor laws, and I have the solution on that that neither has. But anyway, we'll talk. You said let's wrap it up. I hope to hear from you again.
Yeah, this is great. Well, thank you so much for joining.
Talk soon.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, sir. Bye-bye.
Very interesting fella. We'll see how his campaign goes as it builds up momentum. It'll be interesting to see if the Democratic Party welcomes him in. Or not. Let's see if he ends up running as an independent or as a Demtarian, as he calls it. So if you want any information on my guest today, go to my website at sarahwestall.com. And also please note that if you are going to iTunes and some of the other podcast sites for downloading my podcasts. Especially on iTunes, it was deleted. My old show was deleted and my new show is up there. And so if you have it set up to automatically feed from my old show, you will not be getting my new show. So please look at that. It might be a little tricky to get it set up, but I will have the actual link and directions on my website to view there and to fix that problem. But I hope everyone for now has a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.